Season 4 of Ego Gradia is in the works, so before pushing ahead, let's pause and have one last look at the series wrapping up. In Season 3, our guests examine their roles at the drawing board, what they control, directly or indirectly. We took a top-down view of carbon, the material choices and operational energy use that make up our footprint, and also a bottom-up view of what practitioners do. Here is some of what we learned from all that was said. Welcome to Eco Gradia, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Kishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. The lineup of guests for Season 3 was truly global. Alongside headliner Amory Lovins, the world's leading authority on energy, there were practicing architects with different regional perspectives. Tatiana Bilbao from Mexico, Nina Maritz from Namibia, Benny Kuriakos and Amrish Arora, both from India. We looked at the supply chain with Nigel Stansfield from Interface, one of the world's leading flooring manufacturers. We peeked into the boardrooms of stakeholders and developers with Maria Atkinson, a consultant and longtime advocate for change. And we reflected on the state of sustainable architecture with historian Paul Finch, founder and program director of the World Architecture Festival. We also stepped out of the studio for the first time and traveled to Venice to cover the Holcim Awards 2023, where I met the five regional jury chairs. As you can tell, I have a lot to reflect on. Before we start, let me remind you that if you're unfamiliar with some of the projects discussed or would like to know more about the ideas mentioned today, you can go to ecogradia.com to view pictures, notes, and links that we have compiled for you on the episode page. We are grateful for the support of our sponsor for Season 3, the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created 20 years ago to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. The Holcim Foundation website is a reservoir of information. You can learn about past winners of the Holcim Awards from every part of the world, discover the hurdles they overcame, and the strategies they employed. Go to holcimfoundation.org to find out more. First things first, what is it that we do at the drawing board? What is the extent of a practitioner's responsibility towards sustainable outcomes? In episode 8, Paul Finch of the World Architecture Festival gave an unequivocal, emphatic response.
Are architects responsible for the world? And my very clear answer to this is, not only are they not responsible for the world, but they should not be responsible for the world.
Like many, Paul is of the opinion that responsibility depends on where one is situated. In episode 6, for instance, we met with Amrish Arora, who spoke of initiating a relationship with site and local skills, illustrating this with one of his firm's best-known projects, the Raj Jodhpur, a boutique hotel in a desert city in India.
It's a relatively small site of about 1.5 acres in the heart of the bold city of Jodhpur. So the only access to the site, the widest road is, I think, about 3 meters wide. So, and kind of meandering through. So I think the most spectacular thing about the site was what we encountered the first time we went there, where we walked through these narrow streets and we came to this old gate and we walked in and we had the fort hanging in the sky, and it's possibly the most spectacular fort in India and possibly the best maintained one, the Mehrangarh Fort. The biggest kind of challenge in that project was this question of identity, and what we were very kind of cognizant of very early on was the reason people go to a leisure hotel. And increasingly, one realized that when you go to a historic city, then you want a flavor of that region. You don't necessarily want a big brand experience of luxury. You want an experience of what that place has to offer. So this idea of the sense of place emerging through the material and craft kind of got seeded then. I think architecturally, because there were such limited options, the rooms became new structures which became parallel gateways to reveal the view. So they framed the old buildings. There were three old buildings on site, 17th century buildings, which are in really bad shape. So we got got around restoring those in lime and stone in much the manner in which they were built. So we began to study the buildings and bring back the historic elements in those three small buildings, which became public spaces. And then all the rooms came about in three cubes, which framed the site and get views of the fort. And I think that was really the planning idea. Mm. Architecturally, we began to imagine that the buildings would relate to the fort and to the neighboring city, which is the Blue City, so where all the neighboring houses are these blue whitewashed kind of homes, which is peculiar to Jodhpur. And so in section, we began to kind of play with the idea of merging the rooftops with the neighborhood and the plinth. The rest of the building is a plinth that connected with the historic buildings, which were in sandstone on site. And at last but not the least, this idea, they were all east-west facing. So we were always, I think, from the first project, very cognizant of orientation, of sun, of shading. So we proposed air conditioning, the least possible footprint, and kind of deep shading the verandas, and then using the idea of the lattice in stone.
The jali,
and then trying and... For instance, the process of deciding the pattern of the jali and moving away from a traditional kind of motif to a more, I think, cheaper and more contemporary motif, which was still hand done. I think that's where our kind of understanding of the importance of process began to emerge. Is that kind of overtaking, or where the outcome becomes subservient to the process. And brings a certain sense of authenticity to the building.
Whereas Amrish seeks authenticity of a building, others talk of how buildings relate with each other at the urban scale. In episode 1, Imre Lovins, the leading world expert on energy, spoke of integration.
Integration takes many forms. Some of them are arrestingly simple, like do buildings shade each other? Do they reflect glare on each other? Do you want certain buildings near each other or far from each other because of what they are or do? How will people move about in and between the buildings and get into the neighborhood and back to where they're bound? And by the way, are they able to live, work, shop, pray, play all near each other in walking distance? Or do they have to get on public transit or worse in a car to get to someplace else, because we set up rules that separated all these vital functions? Can you get to where you want in a 5-minute walk? At most 10. Well, you should be able to. That's what you get in any city that grows organically. But instead, if you have to get in a car and drive for an hour, that utterly destroys community and partitions your life and wastes a lot of time moving about when you really didn't want to. There are, of course, technical integrations you can do between buildings, swapping heating or cooling, for example, but if they're really designed or retrofitted optimally, probably there won't be much heating or cooling to swap. Maybe some of them have a better solar exposure or roof area than others, and can therefore power a microgrid better. And of course, whenever we distribute, say, solar electric supply, it ought to be wired by default to work with or without the grid. 98 or 99% of power failures originate in the grid, so we can get a roughly 50 or 100 times more reliable electric supply if we don't have the grid necessarily in between the solar panel and the use. Of course, microgrids are good in other ways. They can diversify load, so people use power for different things at different times at different places. But I think in a time of wild weather and some malicious people, it's probably not good to increase our reliance on the grid any more than we have to.
Integration is not confined to systems in a neighborhood. It is very much a question of what we put into a building. Amory spoke of building product manufacturers who reduced their footprint. He even singled out one.
The most fascinating example of this is in carpets. The late Ray Anderson, founder of Interface, had his R&D people come up with a carpet that had every property you would want in beauty and durability and so on, but was completely remanufacturable into identical product with no downcycling. It could be made entirely from renewable materials. It was cheaper and so on. But then he realized, why are we selling people a carpet? All they want is to walk on it and look at it. They don't want to own a bunch of cloth on the floor made of oil. And this business model we have is really pretty stupid. We put the cloth on the floor, and every 10 years it starts to look worn and ratty. So we move out all the furniture, shut down the office, take up the carpet, send it to landfill where it takes 10,000 years turning to methane. And meanwhile, we lay down new carpet made of more oil, move back in, hope we don't get poisoned by the fumes from the carpet glue. So he said, look, let's lease people a floor covering service, and we'll use carpet tiles in the European fashion, and we'll freelay them, no glue, and hold down the corners with a little biomimetic disc, like gecko foot technology, nano hairs adhering with van der Waals forces. So you can roll up the whole thing like a broad loom, or you can lift out each tile separately and lay it back down again. You just, if somebody spills something on it, you just take it outside, wash it off with a garden hose, bring it back in, put it down, and the nano hairs grab it and hold it down. And we'll lease this as a service. So every month, the little elves will come in the night, and they will clean or replace or refresh any carpet tiles that need it. And those aren't the ones under the furniture, because you're not walking on those, so you don't need to disrupt the office. And we'll actually have more jobs maintaining the stuff on your floor this way monthly than we will lose at the factory making less carpet. And if any tiles that are dirty or damaged beyond repair go back to be remanufactured, we will use 1/1000th the raw material that we used to use making virgin carpet from oil. And this will all be made of corn stover anyway, you know, the waste from maize. So it turned out there were some interesting issues with this. It took 10 years to convince the tax authorities to do a net operating lease. And then the salespeople had to learn to sell to the chief financial officer a financial product rather than selling a bunch of carpet to a building manager. And there were technical problems with the particular carpet technique they were using. Those probably get fixed in due course. But I think it's a really powerful concept. And we're starting to see leasing in lighting services, comfort services. And of course, if you're a building manager, why would you want to lease from a dozen different companies, different services? Somebody's going to start bundling those. So, yeah, you know, it's quite different than the old purchasing stuff model. And generally, too, in a world that's using fewer tons of stuff more productively, you don't want to be selling tons of stuff. You want to be leasing the resulting service. That's why one of the exciting things say, a cement company could do is to not sell tons of cement, but lease the resulting structural services. Or if you're a builder, don't sell somebody a bridge. Lease them the service of moving safely and efficiently across a bridge that you will provide. And if then you can use a really elegant design with probably a small fraction as much material and benefit from that and still provide a better service.
EcoGradia got in touch with Interface, the flooring solutions company that Amory spoke of. I sat down with Nigel Stansfield, the company's chief innovation and sustainability officer, and asked him what it took for a company of this size to turn things around.
We try always to put the lens of four different stakeholders on the question or the opportunity. So the investors, the customers, the employees and the environment, those four key stakeholders. It's not always as clean as that and as perfect as that. It can, you know, we are a publicly quoted business with an investor community. So we are driven to perform and to repeat performance and drive profitability and earnings per share and stock price. Our argument would be that looking at those four lenses does actually complement each other, and you can get into sometimes conflicting, but those conflicting arguments often resolve themselves through dialogue. Most of the time when we have those conversations and they conflict, we resolve those conflicts through innovation or compromise. We get the balance right, ultimately, in our decision-making. But sometimes you just have to make the call. You have to make the tough call.
I'm just wondering, with deep targets like Mission Zero and Climate Take Back, who needs the most persuading in the ecosystem of flooring solutions? I mean, is it your shareholders, your supply chains, your employees? Which was the biggest barrier in getting on track?
In the early stages, the biggest barrier, but also the biggest opportunity, was our suppliers. Mm. Because about 70% of the embodied footprint of our product, we bring into our factory from outside. So about 70% is we buy in. We impact about 10 to 12, maybe 15% in our operations. So our cradle, our gate-to-gate process. And then the in-use is probably about 20%, rough numbers. So initially, we really focused on our supply chain. That was challenging. We've moved away from some suppliers over time because they didn't want to embark on the journey with us. Similarly, we've got further into deeper relationships with suppliers that have particularly shown a commitment to support us. When Ray stood up and said, we're going to be sustainable and we're going to do it by 1999. And he was talking to the marketplace about that. There were some skeptics in the business, but over time, those skeptics have moved on to other things or they've been converted. And I think now our workforce, I said this when Ray passed away in 2011, that we got asked at the time, does this mean the sustainability journey is going to stop? And we said that externally, Ray Anderson was the figurehead of the business and the founding father of our journey and our company. But internally, he was just one of many voices. There were many, many passionate commitment, people committed to the sustainability journey within Interface because they'd grown up through the 17 or 18 years of the journey up until his death in 2011. Yeah, it had been embedded into it. It's like part of our DNA. So you can't extract it now from our people. But at the beginning, it was challenging to get them to buy into it. Mm. I think the board, our board, external board, is super supportive of us. And we have longstanding board members who were appointed by Ray to the board many years ago, who have been with us a very long time. They are very committed to our purpose and our mission, our sustainability journey. We've got the balance right there, strong leadership team, strong board, very committed workforce. We've now got a very committed supply chain predominantly. And we've now got demand being pulled now from the customers.
Right.
As both customers embark on the journey, but also legislation, as I said earlier, as legislation starts to create a pull in the marketplace, a need in the marketplace as well. So, it's a very positive outlook, I think, for businesses like Interface that have been on the journey for a while and can demonstrate with proof points that they have been very successful. Mm.
In the interview, Nigel elaborates on Interface's carbon targets. Decarbonization is one of the most pressing challenges today. Maria Atkinson, in episode 2, spoke on this as well. She discussed the development of carbon tools in a session she chaired at the Holcim Foundation Impact Summit held in the US in early 2023.
The moment I feel for every engineer and every architect and every developer and builder, because at best, 20% of the emissions are calculated with some level of accuracy. 80% at best is made up. 80. So each time you do it, every time you ask someone, you're going to get different outcomes. So carbon accounting is actually very simple if we put the obligation throughout the supply chain. So if I'm extracting raw materials, I can use engineers and scientists to estimate my carbon, what's better known as liability. I can calculate that on the tons or the kilograms or the volume of which I'm extracting and producing. I may own a transport company or I may not. I might sell my raw material and a transport company buys it and moves it. That transport company might use hydrogen or electric solutions, less carbon intensive transportation mechanisms. It should take the product, inherit the liability, add on their own carbon liability, and then move it along the chain. Somebody buying that at the end of it can make a decision about which transport company it's going to go with because it's getting less or more carbon emissions. If each time we calculate it on the balance sheet of what is sold in the market, the carbon liability, in the same way we do profit and loss, in the exact same way on a balance sheet, we would have throughout the supply chain information on carbon intensity, and we would all be able to make decisions on anything we buy. In the same way, this morning if you ate cereal, you may have looked at the packet and decided, am I going to have these fats or these sugars? That information is readily available to you. You might have a salt intolerance, and when you're in the supermarket, you choose products and materials based on, or choose products to consume based on salt intolerance. If I want to make decisions on carbon, I don't have any of that transparency. And it's actually simple, it's needed, and it means that everyone has an obligation. And beautifully, countries would be able to look at what is produced in their country and they would have a carbon liability for their country. Yeah. It'd be fantastic.
How does one operationalize this transformation of supply chains, though? I mean, I'm wondering what would make suppliers do the math on this, do the accounting on this. I can imagine, you know, in a highly regulated environment like Singapore or Australia, it might well be regulatory obligation. Mm-hmm. But in so many other parts of the world, supply chains are so complex and unregulated. How do you get that data? Again, back to the drawing board. How do I get, you know, 80%?
How do you get the information that you can trust, right?
So yeah, exactly.
I think when we're talking, let's just talk a building. I mean, the biggest embodied carbon issues are steel, then concrete, then aluminium and glass, and then we go down to sublevels like insulation, et cetera. But, you know, the big ones are those steel, concrete, aluminium procurement. So if I need to make decisions about that, that supply chain, although it is fractured, it's global, it's not a local supply chain in most cases, it is more than small to medium enterprise. They tend to be big players. So in those big players, can I extract the information that is required? They themselves are trying to work on how they can provide it in real time. And I think that's the wonderful next generation of activity. So we've got some great innovation around steel and concrete procurement. We've got great answers, solutions. We've got more sustainable steel, more sustainable concrete. And we also have emerging structures that are coming out of alternate materials to steel and concrete. And we've got innovation occurring, not just in timber, but in all sorts of other structural places. So if I'm an architect or an engineer, then I need to be engaged with the steel, the concrete, the aluminium and the glass industry. And in the network across competitors, it's the kind of thing you would do as an industry association or come together collectively with the help of government to facilitate conversations. It's actually not that hard. I don't think it's that hard to start somewhere to end up with a base case. But everyone's way of calculating embodied carbon is also messed up. So we need to standardize the way in which people calculate. Those engineers and architects are calculating it so the developer can trust that if they go to different consultants, they will at least have the same methodology applied. And that was the breakthrough of the Holcim Foundation Impact Summit for the group I was chairing, was that they laid out and agreed a methodology that all of them, the Rocky Mountain Institute, ACOM engineers, all sorts of great minds would apply the same methodology to their process. The big question is around access to data and the sharing of data. The Holcim Foundation conversation, that impact summit, was to unpack it, simplify it, say to the industry, what can we do now? But also in parallel, what's something that may take many years to achieve, but we can start today?
So the methodologies and the accounting protocols are on the way, and that this transparency is going to percolate through the industry. But for now, I suppose what you're saying then is that make sensible choices, narrow it to a few big ticket items, and make good procurement choices. Go for the companies that give you the data as opposed to the ones that don't.
Exactly. And the Impact Summit had another working group, and they ended up developing a buyer's alliance. And they were all competitors. They're all big builders in the industry, and they came, and government, and they came together and they said, why don't we write the standard for the procurement that will all push out to the industry? So for the poor industry, they're getting consistent message of expectation, and that enables them to invest in the change to deliver what the standard is. And so I think that's a wonderful way of doing it, respectfully understanding the supply chain needs time, needs support and consistency. So don't treat it as a competitive advantage. Find your competitors and do it together and say, we need to support the supply chain to change. Therefore, we're going to have consistency in what we're asking for.
If as an architect or an engineer, I'm specifying low carbon concrete, then that's going to send a signal to suppliers. And that's the bit that as advocates, you can do, make those choices. Yeah.
Yes.
What about the boardroom? I mean, the drawing board is one question, and I think we're all wired to think of the common good. In the boardroom, how do we talk about carbon and embodied carbon as a question of profit and loss?
It's a very big conversation at the moment. So directors have an obligation to be honest and to demonstrate that they've asked hard questions of their executives and they understand the impacts of their organisation that they're sitting on the board of. So there is a kind of corporate governance, ethical responsibility of interrogating impact. No denying, for most organisations, there is a carbon liability impact. And I think a lot of directors have had the time to get educated, to be asking the right questions. I do not believe that the majority of organisations are reporting honestly all of their emissions. We talked about the greenhouse gas protocol, the ways in which carbon is accounted for. But for example, many industries that are big emitters are still not reporting their fugitive emissions. It's an unregulated, government slow to react, and therefore emissions are being unaccounted for. So my message for developers is, one, you better be educated. You need to know about this. This is the same kind of interrogation and expectation as your normal accounting governance. And with transparency, you should be reporting what you know and what you don't know and what your roadmap and timeline is to find out what you don't know. And I think I do think in the next decade, if we're serious about climate change and we know that carbon is a key contributor to climate change, then it deserves to be treated with the same transparent, verifiable methodologies that we do money.
Season 3 juxtaposed global perspectives, such as Maria Atkinson's, with local ones. Alongside Maria, I spoke with three practitioners who raised the importance of bottom-up design thinking, starting in episode 4 with Benny Kuriakose, an Indian architect who handcrafts his buildings.
I've been searching for an answer for the last 4 decades. I will say about 4 or 5 years ago, I found the answer. Now, when I say this is the way to build, I'm 100% convinced that this is the only way to build.
What is that?
I mean, this way of sustainability, global, I mean, we have to fight it. We have to learn from our traditional techniques, all these things, climate responsive design, we can try to make the houses more thermally comfortable, all these things we have to do. So it is not very easy. Many of the questions which I asked when I passed out, I didn't have answer at that time, but now I know which is the way to go ahead. So the important thing is that this has to reach a wider population. So the effort where I would like to spend a major part, I mean, the rest of my career is to address this issue. I'm not very clear. I have certain ideas, but let us try to get the benefits of design and technology and science so that the rest of the 90% get some benefits out of the modern knowledge systems, building science, and sustainability principles.
Nina Maritz is an architect from Namibia. Like Benny, Nina focuses on small, crafted buildings. In episode 7, she speaks of frugality as a starting point.
I've built up a kind of a lexicon of materials, building technologies, approaches, etc. And it's very much based on site. So one of the things that we do when we go to a site is we do a materials audit. We look at what materials are there or are in the vicinity that we can use. All manufactured building materials except cement is imported. So you can imagine the embodied energy in terms of grey energy that these materials use. So it starts with the site, the existing materials. Passive design is extremely important because we don't have the money for technology and we don't have the skills to maintain technology in any case. You want to stay away from machinery as much as possible.
Both Benny Kuriakose and Nina Maritz make a case for simple rules that become the DNA of design thinking. Tatiana Bilbao, the world-renowned architect from Mexico, also a jury chair for Holcim Awards 2023, sums it up nicely in episode 5.
I would say contract the footprint and expand your social network. If we are able to understand our interdependency and rely on that for everything we need, then we would really become much more sustainable, meaning produce our own food, but produce our own care, produce our own sustainability in everything. Right now, we rely on the institutions for care, for health, for food, for or the institutions and the system, no, for all of that. If we would be able to rely on people for all of it around us within a community, then we would be able to reduce our footprint in full, you know? So I think it's the two senses. We have become a society, much more individuals that rely on money to be able to care for ourselves. And to produce that money, we need to expand our footprint. If we rely on people instead of money, I think that if we would understand that health starts in our own domestic environment, that care is the most important thing that we have to have, that we can produce our own care, our own reproduction system within our community, and we don't need to rely on the institution and the thing, we would reduce the footprint in full.
Let me end today, as we started, with a quote from Paul Finch from episode 9. I typically close every episode by asking my guests what gives them hope. Here was Paul's answer.
What gives me hope about architecture is that fundamentally and inevitably, it is an optimistic activity because all architecture, even restorations of castles and churches, are in fact about the future. So we have a condition in which 1.2 million architects around the world are thinking every day about doing something which most of them will be thinking will be trying to improve the world, making things better in some way.
That's a wrap for season 3. Thank you for listening in. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to EcoGradia on your preferred directory or listening app. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. Your support could go a long way to pique the interest of others, your friends, your colleagues, other listeners, or even future guests, and help us deliver more content and grow. You can find all our episodes and related notes at ecogradia.com. Don't forget to check out our sponsor, the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. Find out more about the great work that they do at holcimfoundation.org. And finally, a big shout out to the team who put this whole season together: EcoGradia's producer, Maxim Flores, managing editor, Kruti Choksi Kothari, senior communications executive, Sana Gupta, our sound technician and editor, Kelvin Brown from Flogiston. EcoGradia will be back in January 2024. Do follow us on social media or subscribe to our newsletter to know when the first episode will be released. Until we meet next, this is Nirmal Krishnani, signing off in Singapore.